development.
I guess maybe, I would find it useful to just start with just a very short thing like, what is scaling and why are we interested in scaling and what kinds of systems are used now to think about, like, why are we talking about spindles and what kinds of biological systems? Just a short.
Okay, I can start. I'm the most union person here, the least experienced. Maybe one reason I think it's interesting in cell biology is we think about these structures as having defined functions like the nucleus or the spindle for segregating DNA. And one kind of first guess might be that these structures would not change size, that they have kind of fixed assembly, that the same number of parts are put together and that you achieve some structure that has some function. But then the observations have been made actually now for over 100 years that actually the sizes of these things will scale with the size of the cell. And the early embryo has proven to be a really useful lens, whether it's looking in C. elegans or Xenopus, at the change in size of these structures. So that's the observation, and then I guess the harder nut to crack is function. So if you misregulate the sizes of things, what are the consequences? Does that give you changes in transcription, or do you get lagging chromosomes? And that's still very open. But I think I like the question from an assembly standpoint of like, how can you build machines that are different sizes and still functional? But what do you think, Frank?
Yeah, I also find this point fascinating. If you can build cells of different size using the same genes and molecules, and that the size can vary a lot, in particular during early development, and that somehow the relative sizes are adjusted such that the cell looks similar.
Right. Right.
And so that's, in that sense, they're scaling, that the patterns are the same and the size changes.
And we should probably.
And we see the same features again also when it comes to morphogenesis and
offspring. Right, exactly.
That you have scalable patterns. And you can ask, how do you build systems that form structures and patterns that can be scalable and can be built at variable sizes depending on temperature and nutrient conditions and many other conditions? But the patterns, the shapes are fixed, the sizes are not.
In this connection, a naive question. If I compare mouse and elephant has bigger cells or more cells of the same size?
More cells.
Blue whale
have more cells.
More cells.
More or less the same size.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think in Drosophila there are some differences in size, and isn't there some cases where it's cell size that changes the weight? And sometimes it's a number of cells. It's not always the case that it's
Yeah, so there is some scaling of cell size with organism size, but it's so much smaller than the change in number of cells. So like many orders of magnitude in one versus, you know, one order of magnitude in the other. So I think it's...
So the first approximation is the number of cells.
Correct.
I think both cases exist.
Yep.
Sometimes size changes with cell size, sometimes size changes with cell number, and also genetic perturbations, which you or one or the other. Because on the liver tissue, as far as I remember, you can get cell volume changes, which then give rise to organ size changes.
Depending on pathological condition in one organ or in another one.
I don't remember.
There's an observation actually for toxic injury to liver that to regrow the liver, you first go through a cell size state that's much smaller. And so, I think more and more people are kind of interested in this question of how cell size is dictating function, either through gene expression or just on its own physical constraints, kind of controlling the output of the cell. Largely this is observational. I think moving into the cell started from thinking about differences in a whole organism size, like seeing a species in the wild that's a miniature and seeing a larger one, and then as people started to look more like patterns in tissues and seeing that this kind of French flag model, that the things are maintaining the same aspect ratio. And then the cell is really the last one to come online in terms of seeing scaling patterns in the cell. It's kind of how we think about it.
So I'm more used to thinking about genetics. So if I see two things that are correlated, you don't, you know, they can be both caused by a common thing, or the one is influencing directly the other. So you have correlations like that. So when you see the scaling relationships, what's your idea in terms of mechanisms? Is it one controlling, like you mentioned some of that in your talk, one controlling the other, or both are controlled by a certain thing that makes the, that links them by some relationship?
You're talking about?
When you have a scaling
phenomenon.
Relationship
structure.
Yeah, in structures like the spindle you mentioned in some slides.
I guess, yeah, this question comes up a lot. I don't want to dominate your floor here in terms of answering things.
So. Yeah, go ahead. I mean, I'll try and put it in evolutionary scenario. Should just be a free flowing conversation anyway.
The nucleus, I think, is maybe the place where this is the hardest to understand, is if the nucleus is enlarged and this changes transcriptional output or other things, can that dictate then the size of the cell?
Yeah.
But mostly we try to isolate these parameters, so if you have a cell of a certain size, if you can artificially make it bigger, what is the effect on the nucleus or other things? So many of these things are tied together. And there are ways, certainly computationally or thinking about theory, to decouple it. And you know, what we try to do, at least in vitro, is just focus on one piece of it, which ignores the fact that it could also be, could a larger spindle be forcing a cell to be larger? It's hard for me to imagine that mechanism. Okay. It could be mechanical, but you know, we only study kind of one half of it at a time.
Maybe to add something on C. elegans there. I think there are some hints, for example, that the centrosome size scales by some limiting component, but that the centrosome size itself somehow regulates spindle size. If I just change the centrosome size, it can change spindle size. And so there's an interplay of mechanisms. And probably it's a variety of cases in different systems.
Yeah.
You're asking
because when you during evolution say you want it, you know, you evolve larger cell size, then if the mutations that bring you there also changes the spindle at the same time, then it's always like that, then you get that scaling thing. Or if you change cell size by some mutations and cell size itself regulates the spindle, you also get the same relationship. So in terms of evolution, I'm trying to figure out how what comes first and what's causing. That's kind of a genetics, you know, which one?
Well, it's interesting, might be worth thinking about what would be tolerated. So could a cell grow larger than its spindle and that still be okay, versus if a spindle grew larger in that kind of ancestral cell, what would be the costs associated with that?
Yeah, and could create a cost, and then you need other mutations to change the size of the spindle, or they can both come at the same time. And it's a bit like what we were discussing this morning. You need to change two things at the same time, otherwise it won't fit together. It's completely different evolutionary mechanism, right?
Yeah.
In one case, it's easy. In the other case, or depending, I guess, on population size and the mutation target and everything, it becomes a difficult problem. So it's also almost as if it's a trivial problem if it's mechanistically named. And it becomes a very interesting and very complex problem. If it's not, maybe I'm pushing a little bit, but
no.
In terms of evolution,
yeah. I think you're right. So this argument happens all the time in evolution. People are always seeing correlations between two traits, right? All the time, like number of eggs produced, body size, you name it. The more sort of emerging things.
So could we, in fact, since you mentioned that word, just to step back before you take this, so we have to distinguish, since it's a discussion on scaling, between, say, correlation between two variables, where you know one seems to increase, the other one decreases, between y being a function of x, you can always draw a line or some curve, and a scaling law, which is different from these two previous things. These are not all the same. And scaling, almost always people talk about some power, and there's a long history in physics of those kinds of observations giving you a lot of inside. Some of it might be approximate, like we saw the one-third scaling, which in fact turns out to be sort of the low-end limit of some curve. And I think the most interesting type of scaling is when you have to scale multiple things at once to get the same system back. So you gave an example of an equation where you rescale population size, you rescale time, and you get back the exact same thing again. And really, that's what the heart of scaling is. It's if you solve one case for some value of parameters, then you automatically solve for a huge number of other parameter combinations. I mean, that's what scaling should be. And it's rare. And usually it only happens when you have an equation. But you might.
Well, I don't know. So let me. I mean, maybe you're right. Let me point out something else. Like, you know, I mean, you can get the equation from scaling, but, and let's return to your thing about a law, which is, I guess, I'm interested in about when it becomes a law. But, you know, we have these things in evolution all the time. And you know, some of the cell things that we're talking about. You have X, often X is like a measure of size of the organism. And then Y is some other aspect. And I think it was Darcy Thompson who called this allometry, or it may have been Huxley, I don't remember, but anyhow, you have some pattern. A straight line, they're usually log-log things, and then you have an equation for the line, but in evolution, the question that comes up a lot is, is this an indelible sort of relationship that if you just, so this could be driven just by mutation. Right, that we have all this empty space over here and over there, and maybe there's not even any way to make anything that fits there. So that's one way of thinking about it. And another is that this is all due to selection, that if you mutate over, so then you would have, the idea would be have some kind of selection. This would be like a fitness coming out, and so this would be a fitness topography with a peak and along the ridge. And so this comes up all the time in evolutionary biology. How much of this is a consequence of mutation bias? And I guess this could be sort of usually people talk about this as a pleiotropic effect of mutations, an effect of one mutation in multiple traits. Or is it simply the case that selection doesn't allow anybody to go up here? So either, and these kind of debates have gone on forever, because whatever the solution, the pattern still holds, right? And I guess that's is it a law if the pattern holds? You see what I'm saying? But I would like to know, as an evolutionary biology, the mechanism giving the law. And just to back up, and you know, I presented this with the energy required to build the cell, so that's sort of cell size down here and volume. And to me, another interesting thing is, I mean, you can come up with scaling issues, you know, surface to volume stuff or fractal stuff, and get like a 1/4 or 1/3 multiple sort of relationship. But I'm also interested in the intercept too. Why do the intercepts reside where they do in these relationships? So anyhow, I just wanted to put this into context. This comes up all the time in evolutionary biology. Is it mutation, or is it selection, or is it both? And just relate one more thing. Usually we talk about the phenotype. So this might be the mean phenotype, and you would have a way we would look at this is it's got an underlying genetic value, and then everybody lives in a different environment. And so there's an environmental. This is like if you took a billion of these guys and took the average phenotype, that would be that. But each one realization would have some deviation. And then you would have this for Y. And then you can, of course, the slope there is a function of the covariance between the two. And there's three, you know, the covariance of this and this, there's the genetic covariance, that's the underlying genetics. You could have the covariance just due to the environment. I mean, in insidious cases, you have genotype by environment. So I just want to point out that those are the kind of things that come up all the time. All, you name any kind of bivariate relationship in evolution, that's the kind of thing.
That's why I asked that question, that's been my trend.
Yeah.
And when I see your relationship in maths, that's what I'm trying to understand, because if you think about evolution, all things change.
Yeah.
You know, we have to make a mutational step in one direction or the other, and then you want to see how you move on that plane from there. So that's why the mechanism is important, because in one case it can be trivial. If you change one, it changes the other automatically. That's not a problem. If you have to change both to be on the optimal line, then it becomes an interesting problem. Yeah, I think interesting problem in terms of evolution.
I guess I'm still uncomfortable because it's can I give you a plot with an x-axis and a y-axis and some scatter and something like a line? I mean, that's nice, it's interesting, it's a correlation. What you show is a plot where there's 10 orders of magnitude varying on the x-axis and like 6 orders of magnitude varying on the y-axis, and you get a line. And that's a very different type of plot. So, but
why is it different?
Because you never expect laws to carry over such large ranges of some natural thing unless there is a much deeper explanation for it. You can expect correlations to persist over a factor of 2, no problem, very tight, there's some reason for it. But the kinds of plots you show, and this is interesting because you're the only person who's able to provide us plots that have
Well, if I use log base 100, then it's only one log. No,
but this is very important. So it depends what the natural scales are. We all agree that body size is a natural thing. Gravity responds to body size, right? So it's a natural thing. So you've managed to show us a plot where there's 10 to the minus 10. You've got 20 powers of 10 on the x-axis. I think you went that high, at least one. So he had several, but he had population sizes. He had real population sizes. He also had
You
had the weight of the organism, the number of, or the length scale, whichever one you want, but certainly if you look at the volume, then you have many. And correlation.
Oh, that's got weight, the population size versus weight.
Population size versus weight, where you change over several, you know, at least 10 orders of magnitude, and you get a straight, or, and you get anything that looks like a picture, is impressive and contains a message just saying these two things are correlated. That contains a message saying there's some reason, there's a law, there's some regularity in here.
Well, there's a
at this point there was a bit confused in the equation. You called it population size, but it was rather population density.
It's actually population density.
Yeah.
It's
per unit area.
But are you saying something approaches a law the more?
No, it's not that. No, it's just that if you write down sort of random equations, right, so a differential equation that describes some phenomenon, and you can then solve that differential equation to find, I don't know, the time it takes to do something as a function of the power, you can make plots, right? There's no reason to expect these things to fall on any kind of straight line, and typically you get some curve. In some limiting, in the asymptotes, when something gets very big and something gets very small, these curves turn out to be power laws. So you have y equals x squared, y equals 1/3 x, whatever. Very far here or very far there. If you're lucky, then these, you know, what it means for something to be big or small, you might just always be in the big part of the range or the small part of the range, and the whole thing becomes a power law. And the power laws take you across many orders of magnitude. And at least in physics, that's led to a lot of useful, you know, so if you see such a power law, then you can have a guess at what families of equations might describe it, and it rules out a lot of bad stuff. You don't have to look at it. So I don't know if, so mostly in biology, when you look, when you find power laws, there are two orders of magnitude on the x and y axis. And so you can totally, like there was this huge, so Barabasi had a series of papers in Nature starting 10 years ago about power laws, which have just factored 10 on each axis. That's not a power, that's a correlation. That's all. And that's all I meant. It's just that when you have
a power. You're saying this, right? I mean, why is it a power law? I mean, is 2 orders of magnitude a power law?
It depends how much noise there is. So, but you know, over a factor of 2 or a factor of 10.
You need several decades.
You need several decades, right? So maybe both agree on this. So
can you just say it in words? I'm not sure, because it sounds like what you're saying.
Okay.
We don't expect this to happen, but so if it does happen.
I'll explain. So the difference between, let's say, a physics equation and just statistics is the following. Just statistics is you give me X and Y and a bunch of points. And I can interpolate those points. I can interpolate them using my favorite, I can make a straight line, put a power law, I can do whatever. And that interpolation will be good. That is between this point and this point, whatever other point you measure later would be close to what you interpolate. Nobody disagrees. Now, suppose you make a new measurement at this value of X, that value of X, you know, outside this room, you'd expect it to be on the same line? That's the difference between interpolation and a law. The law says you can extrapolate and you'll still be right. And, you know, we have a rough guess that, you know, so if you only measure microbes, but you then extrapolate to mammals, which seems ridiculous, it was right. You know, so that is saying something. It's saying something rather unexpected. And in physics, people extrapolate.
Yeah, but it's not saying what the mechanism is.
We haven't thought about it.
That's the issue.
But if you're distinguishing between what you were saying before, if you're saying it's all about the evolutionary history versus there's some limitation. If you cross that many, I mean, if you cross that kind of breadth, it seems like you're not just talking about evolutionary history, right? I mean, if you're talking about, those are the two things you're saying, why those corners are.
Yeah, but those are two very different mechanisms. One is that it's just mutation keeping you on the line, and the other is selection. And by just looking at the correlation, you can't tell. Let me just point out one other thing that comes up, and maybe this will help a little bit, because it does talk about different scales. People talk about this all the time in evolution as well.
Sorry, before you erase that, and before we forget what I said, so what did you say? But there's also like physical constraints, like your spindle cannot be bigger, the spindle cannot be bigger than the cell, or something like that. And those are also those corners?
Yeah, I don't know how you define that. That's selection. Yeah, it's potentially physical selection, right?
So it's not just mutation selection, but it's, I don't know.
Well, is that a form of selection that a physical law prevents you from being there?
Maybe not.
If you can make it, you cannot be selected against.
Yeah,
that's all I
see. Well, it's a, you know, I wouldn't call it, sort of trivial to call it a mutational limitation. It's just literally physically impossible. But another thing that comes up.
But that's something you're not, that evolutionary biology isn't thinking about, is the physical limits to these things.
Oh, no, it's talked about all the time.
Okay.
But in pretty loose terms sometimes, I would have to admit. Well, people just say, okay, you've got this pattern because there's some kind of physical constraint. And that's that. Often, right?
Yeah.
But you're drawing into it that when you said you couldn't reach certain parameter values in your plot.
Right. But even physical constraint can mean different things to different people. One, it meaning it's literally a mutations constraint. And another is that you can make it, but it's not allowed by natural selection. Some people would use it, put that under physical constraint. But another, this gets at your scaling issue, so people talk about this all the time. You can think about these allometric relationships and many levels, right? So you could be working with just individuals in a population of flies, and you know that's your scale, right? Or you could be looking at the average value in 800 species of flies, and now you've broadened the range, and maybe that looks like this. Or maybe the scaling's different at different phylogenetic levels. Or you can look at all animals and then it does something. And these are different levels of scaling that people often wonder about. Or you can even look at, if you had a clone, you could think about, everybody's genetically identical. There might still be some scaling as they have different nutrients or something. That's all purely, that's all this. So, I think I've just sort of summed up what you see in the evolutionary literature all the time. People have been arguing about this forever, what are the mechanisms? It's a big deal, and, you know, people, a lot of people are focused on brain body size allometry. Why is the brain in mammals scale the way it does with body size, and is it the same at these different levels?
The caveat, I think, of with any of these scaling curves, when you put up stuff that, you know, included the energy economy scaling for, you know, bacteria or prokaryotes and eukaryotes, was that whatever mechanistic law you might imagine kind of explaining the data, there is the fact that the chemistry of the systems is so different. And so, is it really the same mechanism in all of them? Or is there some other issue and then the chemistry changes between the systems to make them look like they're similar, that that's selected for? But that would be potentially a very different mechanism, that you could achieve a certain energy economy in one cell, you know, by the limited genetic system you have there, but then you can do it a different way in the other one. So the mechanisms could be completely different, but they would still fall on a line. And you would say, hey, look, we have this universal thing that really doesn't tell you about mechanism. That's not a criticism. I mean, it really may be that there's a universal law there, but it's something I think about with the spindles is, as soon as we jump to another organism, something is on that line, does that have anything to do with my mechanism, or is that just that's what's been selected for and there's, you know, more than one way to skin a cat?
But I would still think, according to what you said, if there is a real power law over several decades, it's likely that you find a common explanation, even though the systems are very different along the line. At the same time, I think these cases of the real power laws are quite rare. And we have only very few good examples of that in biology. But often, I think the term scaling should not just restrict to power laws, but it should be much larger in the sense we would understand how systems are scalable and how they change at different sizes, and this can be very different from a power law.
Right.
As I remember, sort of one of the most famous examples of scaling is the metabolic rate as a function of organism.
3/4
size.
Long.
With this nice power law, and actually I think it's very likely that there's a very universal general explanation for that, even though biochemistry can be very different.
Right.
Different systems.
Right. Yeah.
But that scaling, that's a good example too, because that scaling has changed a bit over time. In the beginning, so Max Kleiber originally illustrated this, and I think it was it 3/4 scaling?
3/4 to start.
Mm-hmm. Metabolic rate versus size. Mm-hmm. And it actually, this was mainly with vertebrates, I think. So this relates to your point, too. And it became known pretty quickly as Kleiber's Law. Within a few years, this was back in the 30s or so. And then since then, people have added a lot more data from different phylogenetic groups, and the scaling has changed a bit. But there's been a big debate about it.
Pardon? The power change.
Yeah.
Okay, and what is the modern value?
Pardon me?
What is the modern value of the power?
The modern value?
Yes.
That's a good, it's debated. Because there's two different camps. And this is where things get very strange. I think what he looked at was it's actually the, I thought it was the metabolic rate per unit volume or something, and this, the power was 1/4. So, right, that's 0.25. And Kleiber really never explained why you would have 1/4 scaling. It's not immediately apparent. And then a bunch of guys in ecology, I was talking to somebody about this the other day, came up with some fractal theory. They thought that gives you, so they thought they had, this is what I find interesting in scandalous, is actually come up with a mechanism. And that somehow gave a 1/4 scaling. But a lot of other people have pushed the 1/3 scaling, and you know, that sort of comes naturally with volumetric scaling and, you know, three dimensions and stuff. And so what is that? You know, that's 0.33. If you take a close look at the data, often the actual, and people are religious about this, but often you will see that the actual scaling's like that. And so, you know, take your pick, it's exactly, it's sort of in the middle. I mean, what I find interesting is, you know, is to me the most interesting thing about these scaling relationships, whether you want to call them laws or not, they are patterns that, you know, beg explanation. And I guess I would like to ultimately know what is that explanation? Is it the biophysical level? Or does biophysics have nothing to do with it? It's just selection for some reason just force you into some, you know, there'd be some degrees of freedom. You'd be free to move up and down the line, but nowhere else.
Yeah, I would say that I would not insist that every scaling law should continue for 20 orders of magnitude, and if it continues. If it continues for 19, it does not deserve a name and should be stopped and stretched. I would say that in physics, we know many cases when there are things like finite size corrections and things like
that. Breaks down at the top of the
world. Yeah, it breaks down here and there, and nevertheless, the scaling itself is a very useful concept. So if you get something that changes between one quarter and one third, it may hint on some underlying commonality of principle, which in reality does not continue very far, but nevertheless can give you some useful information.
No, I think we have a very good example of that in Max's
talk. All right, yeah. So,
I mean, I don't know if the one third came in the model independently of the one third.
They're independent. I don't still think I understand what that one third means for the spindle scaling. I don't know how many orders of magnitude it should go across. I mean, right now, things, you know, including C. elegans, the smaller cells in that, if you overlay spindle length as a function of cell diameter, or I guess if you went cell volumes, you had more logs, you would get somewhat of an overlay. But can we conclude that that would be just because of cell volume or size, or is the mechanism likely different in different systems? You know, I presented one organism. How much to extrapolate from that? It's tricky.
But I'm not wedded to the idea of 20 orders of magnitude. It's just that the more orders of magnitude you have, the more you can reject other powers and so on. So given the noise, if you have no noise, then a factor of 2. You know, so this, by the way, this is interesting. There's been this huge debate about whether bacterial cells grow exponentially or linearly from size 1 to size double. Okay, this is a factor of 2. Yeah, and is it a power of 1? Or is it exponential? Or is it some other power? And people have not been able to measure it. And the reason they're not being able to measure it is because it's just a factor of 2. And within the noise of the instrument, you can't.
Or because there is too much noise.
Yeah. Or there's too much real noise. Yeah.
Right. But another way to say it also, you can always define a local exponent by taking the derivative of a log-log relationship. And it's sort of meaningless as an exponent if it's not reaching out a certain range. The question is, how big should this range be to call it a local?
But we have a lot of things that vary over, so size varies over many orders of magnitude, population sizes vary over many orders of magnitude. Genome sizes don't, not meaning well,
10 to the 5th.
Different viruses have that.
No, okay. Small bacteria versus large.
Yeah. Mutation rates vary by about 4 orders of magnitude. Start looking at things across the whole tree of life. We have plenty.
Those are the things you should
order as a magnitude. Metabolic rates per organism. So I don't know, like this thing I pointed out, is that energy to build a cell versus volume. It sort of begs, I think, some kind of biochemical, biophysical explanation. And to me, it's not just the slope, which is almost one across a diversity of kinds of organisms. It's sort of easy to come up with a isometric scaling with volume if you just think of all biomass as sort of being the same stuff, but it actually isn't. I mean, eukaryotic cells have a you know, gross composition that's a bit different. They have more, eukaryotes have more lipids in the cells, for example. But I'm also, you almost never hear people talk about the intercepted scaling relationships. And to me, that's just as interesting, especially if it's an energetic thing like this, because, you know, you could have the same scaling as this one here, but with a much higher intercept, which would imply you need more energy to make your work.
No, so that's a little less meaningful, because that just means you're using the wrong units or something. So the intercept in these scaling models are not on. If you just had one plot with one line, then the intercept is meaningless. If you had one plot with two lines, two different clades somehow were shifted vertically, that's meaningful. But one plot with one line, it's just a question of what the, you know, so it's just a fact.
But exactly, I didn't make it clear. What do you mean by intercept? This is local.
Local, so it doesn't mean anything.
The normalization constant is the word I should. Well, there is a difference in intercept here because the slope is one. The power is at roughly one. So, but we could call it the normalization constant. It would be the value you would take on at value one.
Yeah, so, you know, that's a matter of units.
I don't think it's a matter of unit. So if this says it takes 10 to the 9 kTPs, you know, I'm saying why isn't it 10 to the 10th? What's the biological limitation?
Yeah.
And why couldn't you be down here much more efficient at 10 to the 8th?
Do you refer to the fact that there is a minimal volume and you cannot go the volume smaller than minimum, which is an obvious violation of scaling, by the way, in traditional physics sense. There is a cutoff, and then there is also a cutoff in energy.
Yeah.
The minimal cell or minimal organism has volume, I don't know, 1 cubic meter or.
Well, I guess the minimum would be just above the size of a ribosome.
Okay.
It's a definition of death is when you don't have any ribosomes.
There's a point where you become small enough that the energetics couldn't make sense to sustain life, I'd have to assume, and that's probably something like what the intercept suggests.
No, this is an intercept on a log plot. It doesn't say anything like that.
With the slope having a magnitude of one, the scaling factor could still represent, say, something related to just there's kind of energetics that
the smallest cells are, I think, mycoplasms.
Are these the size of ribosomes?
They're bigger than ribosomes, but but they're small enough, so if you know how many molecules per cell, they're down at such a, so the idea I think is that, I think you're right, that I mean, there's certain things that are non-scalable with respect to cell size. So you need this room left over for everything to run the show.
If you draw these linear scales, so this is log, this is log.
Yeah,
sure. And this is now linear scale. And this is standard. This line ends.
Yeah, there's not a biologically meaningful zero.
Yes, so you are talking about this volume, which is an important biological volume, the minimal possible cell, and minimal possible amount of energy that you need to grow cell. Those are meaningful numbers.
But I'm just thinking at the very low end, it might not necessarily follow the scaling modes. If you try to interpolate it all the way down to zero, you might still get an intercept there by.
It's possible.
There doesn't seem to be any reason why it necessarily has to scale exactly with, say, volume times some constant.
Somewhere here, and then this number will be E1. I would argue that the number E0 makes more biological or physical sense than the number E1.
Well, there's a small number of effects. There's a lot of very nice recent work on bacterial growth laws. Mm-hmm. and they build, so people measure bacterial growth versus growth as a function of, or size as a function of growth rate, or growth rate as a function of nutrient abundance, and so on. And just recently, people have started to put together models that are able to recapitulate these things. These models generally do involve ribosomes, because the first job of a ribosome is to make new ribosomes. And then what's left over can make the rest of the cell. And that leads to very natural scaling. And because ribosomes are molecules, there are these finite number effects that happen right at the bottom. I don't know how close cells come to that, but these new models of bacterial growth do predict those smallest viable cell size in terms of number of ribosomes and so on. It's not one. It's something where the catalytic efficiency is able to replace one in just the amount of time we need. This kind of thing. It's a nice field, but I don't know how much it's what we're doing now.
And people are interested just in the synthetic biology perspective. So you want to just build the minimum, what is the minimum cell?
When you have to ask there, are you talking about a modern cell, or are you talking about something that has self-replication?
Oh, when you have self-replicating.
Where you don't have ribosomes.
No, where you do have ribosomes.
But that's what I mean, you're talking about like modern cell or protocell?
I'm talking about a modern cell. But what is the simplest cell, self-replicating entity?
Because that might push you back, you know, beyond B0, B0.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would be one of the questions.
Well, you don't need ribosomes for a self-replicating protocell. I probably mentioned I'm somebody who works with mostly synthetic biology stuff, but there's papers on that where basically you, if you just have a self-replicating ribozyme and free-floating single RNA nucleotides floating around in a system with a lot of free lipids, the right ribozymes can actually, through their growth and osmosis, cause replicating cell bubbles to form around themselves and sort of split off and keep growing indefinitely as long as they're given the right precursors. And there hasn't been a lot of work done on the scaling limits of that, but it definitely seems like it's not bound by the same constraints from the two or three studies I've seen where people managed to achieve it.
I didn't think they'd achieve self-replication of the genome,
just the ribosome itself replicates itself. What happens is that locally depletes nucleotides, causing more to diffuse across the lipid membrane, causing the membrane to grow and split. Mostly the Shostak lab that has a couple papers on that. But.
Did people study similar relationships for man-made devices? For instance, how much energy you need to produce, I don't know, from watches to airplanes, from some things very small to things very big. I would guess there is some also relation. Is it powerful or
so which policies do you have in mind?
For instance, the amount of energy you need to produce a certain thing, starting from watch to aircraft carrier, also motors and
whatnot. If it's small enough, then it probably takes more energy to make something like.
I don't know. I have no idea.
It's a big decision, like a lock mechanism versus something like a pencil that doesn't require any special tools.
So this is actually a very interesting point. So, and it connects to what you were saying. It depends where you draw the boundaries of the system. And if you do allow stuff to float around, it depends how complex that stuff is, how much do you want a cell to do. But even real cells, of course, have stuff that they can pick up, which is why it's always even puzzled me that these kind of metabolic so for example, okay, so you've shown in many cases with your pictures that you can go from prokaryotes to eukaryotes and you get reasonably good scaling. In some of your pictures you can go from eukaryotes to multicellular eukaryotes and you get reasonably good scaling. What if you go from multicellular eukaryotes to societies, or cities? I mean, there are scaling laws for cities, there's some all kinds of funny things, right? But at some point, if you look at metabolism, how much energy I need to sustain myself. If I, as a human or a human society, can build, you know, huge things, orbiting stars, that will take care of any energy requirement that I can foresee forever, then we are unbound by the scaling laws. And I don't know why, I think it's already quite clear that biology has invented ways to break free from earlier constraints. So you invent a new way of doing something, you farm, not just humans, but other organisms. And so by farming, you've just broken free of some surface to volume issue you had earlier. You should easily be able to violate all these scaling laws of metabolism. So this is why I don't understand why they should.
Well, if you remember, the variance in these curves was, you know, tenfold, right?
Tenfold? Okay, good thing.
Well, with, I mean,
yeah, that's one of the organisms issue about a lot of these scalings is when they go across 20 orders of magnitude, the range at any one point can be two orders up or down or the line. The big pictures remains.
I guess the sort of follow up to that is how much time has humanity had to evolve since we invented farming? We're still potentially constrained a lot in terms of these scaling laws that, for ourselves as organisms, even if how we affect the world is unbound, we haven't had time for our sort of fitness and survival relations to really adapt to that yet. So it seems like a sort of different direction.
So is that similar to saying that your sort of lower units of evolution are still constrained by their old relationships with blood vessels and transport and so on, even though we... So if you take a human cell and grow it in culture, you get the same laws as, let's say, unicellular, if you can.
Well, sure, but human cells have existed in multicellular organisms for many, many time orders of magnitude longer than humans have lived in societies.
Yeah.
Now, there's actually a lot of debate on this now. Like taking different human cells, different tissue types, and then looking at the scaling. I mean, they're out in a culture all alone, right? They behave quite differently than they do, presumably, in the human itself. But also, you can have some that scale this way and some that scale that way. It sounds a bit of a mess.
Okay,
that's good.
Okay.
So I don't know. At least I find these bioenergetic scalings interesting. I don't know if it, as more from the physics end of things, see any way to come up with some general explanation.
One question is context. So you showed the energy needed to build a cell or for the life of a cell as a function of volume, and then we have also discussed that there exist these metabolic rate scalings. Are these two related? So can you relate your scaling plots that you showed to the metabolic rate scaling plots that are classic?
I guess the way I think of it, it's a little bit unclear what metabolic rate means, right? I mean, it's
a flux of energy.
Yeah, it's respirate, you know, usually measured in the old days, I guess it'd be oxygen consumption or carbon dioxide.
But you could also...
But some of that is going into growth, and some of it's just maintenance. That's why I like this other chemoscat approach, because it enables you to separate the growth requirement from the maintenance requirement. I mean, that's the way I look at it. I find metabolic rate a little bit hard to interpret. Well, it has an interpretation, but in terms of what's happening at the cellular level.
It has to do with kinetics also. It tells you about flows of energy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Of course, it involves both the growth and the maintenance, but if you would have a steady state organism, it would all be maintenance.
Yeah.
Is the clever law stuff that's mostly historically with multicellular organisms, has that been extended down to single cell?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a big debate that's been going on in this over the past few years.
Okay.
It's about this kind of thing over here. There was a.
I guess what I mean is, does it look similar once you get down to, once you're no longer.
I don't know if I can quite remember this. I probably have it on my computer. I think for metabolic rate, I think that I'll have to look it up. I think what it does is I think it's down here, I think bacteria scales at a higher rate. Was it you I was talking to this about the other day, Greg?
Yeah.
So Greg knows some of the stuff, he's more up on it than I am. And then I think it drops off out here. This might be multicellular, this might be unicellular, because I don't remember. And this is bacteria has a, I think, a higher scaling.
And there's a metabolic rate versus the organism volume?
Well, I think usually they report metabolic rate per unit volume. Is that correct?
Or mass.
Or mass. Yeah. Or mass, yeah, mass.
I think the initial claim from West and Enquist and Brown was that their law extended down to mitochondria.
Yeah.
I don't think that was just.
And they did some process stuff, right? And then some recent guys did some other, I think, well, new, maybe a little bit more of what they were talking about with fractals. And they didn't get the same scaling.
So can you read through that law, so that, that line, so that it's kind of bent in places corresponding to different sizes of organisms?
Yes.
Is there any reason to assume that it might be, say, scale with 1/4 in one segment, and then next segment get a little closer to 1/3 as, say, energy or growth consideration?
It could be this is one continuous curve. The problem is, you know, prokaryotes, there is overlap. So there are some big prokaryotic cells that are bigger than the tiniest eukaryotes, but usually people aren't working on the bugs right in the interface, so you end up with this situation where everybody up to here would be all prokaryotes, everybody there would be eukaryotes, and so you don't really know if it's a universal scaling.
Because you mentioned like it not necessarily being growth decoupled from maintenance energetics, and my question looking at that, would there be any reason that sort of as you get to different sizes, different factors become more less important in energetics, things like, I don't know, heat transfer and thermoregulation that might affect smaller versions more than large ones, such that you don't necessarily have a linear power law, but a lot of different power laws that kind of add together to make one with a slope that's about 0.29 when you average it over all the different regions.
But are you asking if they did the statistics incorrectly?
No, I'm asking if anybody has sort of proposed something of saying, well, maybe it is 0.25 here and 0.35 somewhere else.
So that would be the general expectation. It's very rare that you'd expect the same. In fact, the general expectation is a bunch of disconnected lines. Okay. First of all, there's no reason for them to even be continuous. The fact that they're continuous is meaningful. But even if it's continuous, it can just be a curve. That's the second most generic expectation. I think the fact that they're continuous is worth exploring.
Sure.
Even more than fixating on the power law, you find exactly those examples of prokaryotes and eukaryotes that sit at these junctions and propose that people make them model organisms and study. That might help.
Yeah, you want to actually be overlap.
Right. Do we know? So, can we have a list of these organisms? We can.
Yeah, I mean, the oceanographers have been really trying to find what's called phycoplankton, the smallest planktonic organisms that are eukaryotes. So there's quite a few known. Many of them, I think, can't be cultured in the lab. And there's some huge bacterial cells, but they're rather strange. Like there's this Epilopistium that lives in some organ of some fish. And yeah, the cell's like a millimeter long. But I don't think there's any way to culture that thing either. And it's a symbiont, so that raises your questions.
But a good test case would be so archaea and bacteria span roughly the same orders of magnitude of cell size and genome sizes. I don't know if they follow the same curve because they have slightly different biomes. Slightly different.
Well, then you have all kinds of temperature issues. Because usually the hierarchies are living at extreme temperatures.
Not always.
Not always, but the number that don't is pretty small. anyhow, if anybody has any ideas on how that this might be explained. I mean, I guess I don't mind calling a very strong peripheral relationship across many logs a law, but that doesn't necessarily provide any explanatory power, it's just an equation.
If you go law from the that's a hell, then it's no better.
So the things that you call, that you're calling power laws, are those like things that we know everybody believes? What makes?
Oh, no, no,
what
no,
gives something that name?
That's a little L. It's not a big L.
Okay.
It's a straight line and log. If you leave the straight line, log.
So we all believe that, right? Don't believe straight line.
No, in ecology, they just make these regressions and they call it follows a law. They just say it follows a power law. Period.
Yeah.
All
you
else.
Said,
you
no,
sort of,
yeah,
okay.
Just giving it back authority.
It does give it a feeling of authority.
Yeah. Power relationship.
That's what that's I right. Think there is sort of a, you know, authority. It just doesn't necessarily explain it. To me, it says there's something here to be explained.
So, what kinds of biological problems are being approached using this sort of asking these kinds of rescaling questions? Are there like
cell biological or biological?
I don't know. I'm just trying to get a sense of is this something that cell biologists think about versus something that's more pervasive than. So it's not something I think about like that much at all. I'm just trying to understand sort of how does this fit into the big picture of how people are thinking about understanding biological phenomena.
I guess I don't want to overreach. I feel like it's a small group of people thinking about it, and I, even for me, I thinking about the evolutionary aspects of it is very different than like what's the mechanism that this one organism uses to achieve scaling. So. This is kind of new for me as well, thinking about what, how this could relate to other organisms or you know, trying to extrapolate more universal laws from it.
But the way to think about it is to say that we know the molecular components, and the molecules are nanometer size, and now we see that we build bigger structures, and what sets these length scales? So where do these lengths come from? The size of a cell, the length of the microtubule, the diameter of the nucleus, size of spindle, where do they come from? They cannot come from molecules. They come from collective behaviors of many molecules, and it's a next level question of what to term scales.
But I think this point you made about something out, because I think of myself as a cell biologist, but I'm careful how I say it, but I think it's the same thing you said, which is we have to get beyond, you know, my organism looks like this and it has this size of nucleus. To the kinds of things that you're thinking about, which is what are the principles of relationships between spindles and
things like that.
So,
I guess, these questions are being framed to a different way. Frank's saying, how do you get self-organization and complex behavior and really interesting things, and being able to have scalability in organelle size or size of a microtubule or a spindle is one of those. And the other piece is it applicable to, you know, thinking about how things are working in another organism. And I, that, at least to me, seems much like less of what people are doing is trying to, this is more of a kind of a biochemistry and assembly question than it is an evolutionary question. But maybe you have different communities of people who are thinking about it differently.
Well, probably involves both aspects.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess what I mean, I get less questions on how it, you know, these principles might determine evolution than, you know, what are the components, what are the principles of polymerization and so on.
Well, Eric and Jim Regan in Basel has got a bunch of my scaling laws where scaling relationships, where he's looking at a fraction of a genome that has different types of proteins, transcription factors, metabolic, and so on. Right? So those things also
show certain divisions. That's a different kind of, it's not size, but it's something else. Make some nice story.
Listen, let me ask a provocative question. Suppose that I, being very stupid, I take out of many numbers that characterize cell, I take two blindly, completely arbitrary numbers, and then I take what is the probability that I get more or less a straight line?
It's low.
Mm-hmm.
Low. There's enough diversity that you will not get a line.
Really?
We can try it, but yes.
I don't know, I have no idea what it is. Sometimes it seems that there is a law that everything is linear, it's not law.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Any
there is one other question that I've seen posed pretty infrequently, but you know, like I think a plot like that where you're plotting something versus cell volume, yeah, it's mostly unicellular species, but when you get to eukaryotes, there is the idea that a larger fraction of the cell is in your vacuoles.
Yeah.
Right, so they're not contributing, there's nothing really in the vacuole that you have to build. And I know the only place I've ever seen this is with some work in plant cells, and I think the vacuolar volume scales, what is it, super isometric, what's the word I'm looking for?
Super linear.
Super linear, yeah. Scales more rapidly than the total volume of the cell. So cells are getting bigger and bigger, a larger and larger fraction of the cell is taken up by vacuoles. So if you just take that, one way of reading that is if you just take the total cell volume, you are not really measuring the volume.
Less.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, putting these, I don't know the numbers, but they're a third or something like that.
Yeah.
Vacuoles. Not fusion-based, but letting these things.
So that would mean if the corrected thing that it would be, I think that would mean that it would be going up faster than if you corrected the volume, right? Because these guys would be moving back here, right? They would have that rate. I think that would make this nonlinear, which would suggest the big guys are less efficient per unit active biomass.
So it's the volume of the cytoplasm is what you're...
I guess, yeah.
Although cells are pretty chock full of lots of things that take up space. Vacuoles are just big and you don't see them.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'm not sure I've read anything that says how do you figure out the cytoplasm volume.
Cytoplasm.
Oh, no, I guess people do this all the time. You lyse the cells, you spin down particular stuff. Huh? And you see what's left. Do you know anything about that?
I was wondering yesterday whether it was the excluded volume.
Like in the spindles, yeah.
Yeah, it was cell volume. We weren't calculating the other components in cell
volume.
As I said, there is a vacuum scaling paper in Buddy Beast from Wallace Marshall.
Oh, okay.
And there, the exponent's 1.3 for volume-dependent scaling, and it's 1 for surface area cell volume scaling. And they have some arguments for why, you know, having a different, like, you might, under different stress conditions, want to have either more number of vacuoles versus, you know, one vacuole and the ability to transport material in and out. Do you want to switch to another topic?
If you got another one, otherwise, I don't know.
Were you going to present anything, Frank? Or?
I could show a few slides if you're interested.
Oh, you want to?
Sure.
Sure. probably can just look up some way. I just
go to my adapter.
Oh, I have. Is it the
which one is it?
Maybe the slate board.
It is the.
Mike, did you already discuss the controversy, even multicellular organisms and these scaling laws?
No, other than what I just mentioned.
The 1/4 versus 1/4.
1/4 versus 1/4.
Yeah.
I pointed out that usually things are about 0.28.
That way,
like halfway between.
I just put a few slides together, motivated by your talk yesterday.
Great.
Add a few aspects. I'm not sure how we should. So that's about spindle length. And one comment is that there are very different spindles. So if you compare the C. elegans spindle to a setup with biotic spindle, in one case, Megatube will essentially reach out the whole length. In the case of the Xenopus meiotic spindle, one has many short microtubules. It's a completely different organization of microtubules. And one is a lower one is more like a liquid crystal, while the upper one is more like a bundle of filaments. And both have very different behaviors. You looked at a similar system, confined in droplets, and we discussed this Xenopus spindle system in the opposite limit, where there's plenty of tubulin, and there's no limitation of size by tubulin. And then one can account for the size, and there's also well-defined size. And one can account for the size by a balance of assembly and disassembly. So in a picture that near the chromatin, sketched in blue, there is a region where nucleation, chromatin-dependent nucleation occurs. There's also microtubule-dependent nucleation everywhere, and then there is disassembly everywhere. But the combination of spatially restricted nucleation with global disassembly gives a balance where a certain steady-state volume appears by a mass balance argument. And this is then an equation for the spindle length that follows from this argument, where alpha is a geometric coefficient, dimensionless, depends on shape, and all the other things involve mass balance. Important parameter is the velocity of polymer of growth, polymerization speed of microtubules. Nu is the nucleation rate per volume in the chromatin region. Tau is the lifetime of microtubules. Rho L and rho are densities, so rho is the overall mass density, and rho L is the mass per length of microtubule. This can be sort of seen experimentally. So there are different spindles and different sizes in this extract. We're just manipulating the assembly rate of microtubules, keeping everything else constant, allows to change the spindle size. So you see the plot growth velocity for the spindle length. That is one mechanism to set size, which I think is complementary to what you described, because you have a limit where you make tubulin restriction. And I think your curve would plateau off at large sizes, which would go into this regime.
Yeah, and this is also a good point, is you know, you're varying the concentration of polymerase here, XMAP 215, which is kind of the other model in development. Maybe cell size would have nothing to do with the effect at all, but if the amount of XMAP 215 is being reduced as development is progressing.
Mm-hmm.
Not that that is the mechanism, but that will be something that I'm, because there's a lot of these studies on factors that affect spindle assembly, if you vary their concentration as you're going through these first divisions, then you can have something that is totally uncoupled from cell size and is kind of this mechanism to deal with cell size, but isn't like a coupling per se.
But clearly the spindle in this case is sort of a phase, tumor-rich phase in the cell, where it's like the extracted, depending on what you look at. And you need material to build this phase, and if you're limited, you could. But here, what's interesting here is that even though there's unlimited supply of material, there's still a well-defined size, which can be regulated by molecular processes. And so this is also related to this point I made earlier, that you want to understand how molecular interaction will set sizes of mesoscopic objects.
I have a question. I mean, like, it's true that you have like infinite system, but I mean, you're not bounded by diffusion, and it's fast enough. In other words, like, it's really in the whole system, you have like infinite amount of tubulin, but then, you know, like, depending on like how fast molecules go and shrink, okay? And maybe you cannot transport all this free tubulin to the spindle. You know what I mean?
Kind of a diffusion of course, flux.
Yeah, I mean, like,
there is a time it takes to build the spindle of a certain size.
Okay.
And the bigger it gets, the longer it takes, because you have to get all the material there. But once you're in steady state, you have no longer fluxes across the surface, essentially, because everything's just turning over inside in the surface picture. So you have negligible to grow, nuclei grow, and then disassemble, and the tubulins that are liberated by the assembly are used to nucleate and grow microtubules.
But then you mean that the size of the spindle, I mean, depend on the history, like, I mean, how you made it first, and then you come to like some. I mean, imagine you start to build something, but then locally, I mean, like, now you have like some tubulin, like concentrated tubulin, and then they go into like tubule, and then they get channel. Okay, is what you're trying to say.
What I'm saying is here, there is a reservoir of tubulin in an extract.
But you don't
it's never depleted. There is excess in the growth phase. So in the growth phase, there's a transient phase in which sort of the reservoir is recruited. But once you have built a spindle, you can actually turn over what is in there.
Okay.
At least that's my picture that is more complex in practice.
I'm talking about this growth phase. Okay. Mm-hmm. Then that depends on like you know, how you grow it first. You know, like, imagine, you know, like, I don't know how to say that. You know, in other words, like, the reason you have, like, for example, like, a smaller spindle is not, like, because then it grew. I mean, like, it couldn't absorb enough tubulin into the spindle before it
becomes... Not in this case.
So are the individual microtubules longer? Mm-hmm.
We don't think so. It's not so easy to measure.
So
then Needleman has methods to measure that. Then Needleman has experimental methods to measure that. And I think the estimates we have is that this doesn't affect. In this case, we only change the polymerization speed. Now you can think of the average length is polymerization speed times lifetime. So in that sense, it can be somewhat longer. But it's difficult to really measure the length.
But can you back your previous slide then? So you're just the previous one. Yeah. So in C. elegans, those are actual microtubules, the full length. The individual.
So there are most of the megatubules or many megatubules seem to reach all the way from
one end to
the other. Yeah. And you can also build half a spindle, yeah, which is only one side. And the megatubules are also more or less straight. Yeah. So geometry, well, as you see, it's not so easy to see the other picture. But the lower picture, you see this ellipsoid-like shape of the.
And what's holding the Xenopus one together?
Many different factors. Motors.
Oh, they're all interconnected.
Crossland groups.
Why would you expect the geometric spectrum not to change with the polymerization speed?
It's not that we expect it, we measure it and it doesn't change. But I think the logic here is one can separate the problem of shape and size as two distinct problems. The shape of the object is set by force balances, particular surface force balances, surface tension, active stresses, while the size is set by mass balance. And so one has to do completely different analysis for shape and size. So if you, for the full model, you need to understand the shape via force balances, and then this determines this shape parameter. But the mass balance is independent of the force balances.
So other organisms have the same kind of organization in materials and that spindle?
It's largely a meiotic versus mitotic distinction.
But still, also mitotic spindles look somewhat differently. There are mitotic spindles that look more like CLN with straight like tubules, and mitotic spindles which have more curved, and that also go beyond sort of the chromatin. So there are different morphologies if you look at spindles. But I think the most clear distinction is the one sort of between meiotic and mitotic.
If you want, if you had one other picture up here of like a fission yeast or a budding yeast, you would also see another very distinct architecture of the spindle. And this is why there's a little bit of a danger of putting all of these on one curve when they have completely different architectures.
Friends, what is tau in your expression?
That's the lifetime of microtubules.
So the what does that mean?
So the simplest picture is that they grow until there's a catastrophe and then they disassemble quickly. And so in a more refined picture, you would have a growth velocity and then probability of the unit time to undergo catastrophe. And then while you disassemble, there can be a recovery event and you can regrow. And now tau is the overall lifetime of a between the nucleation event and the complete disassembly after catastrophe. So you can sort of track the life of one nucleated microtubule, and there's a probability distribution of lifetimes, and that would be the average.
And it's assumed that the whole microtubule you completely disassembled.
If you wait long enough, it always completely disassembled. So if you take the picture of catastrophes and recoveries, there's a distribution of events, but there's always a finite time, a little bit like fixation, it's a finite time type of thing. Not losing the microtubule is like fixation in some sense. Mm-hmm. That's the physical picture. So there's an average time. And in the system, we try to estimate how many recoveries there are, but they're not very common. So usually it's just one catastrophe which leads to the disassembly, complete disassembly of the microtubule. And since nucleation is somehow localized, but the probability sort of to disappear is per microtubule, the lifetime of microtubule streaks, you get this balance of assembly, disassembly, you'll find steady state tubulin mass, and then this translates the via the density to a volume and then to a length.
Can you motivate why it's tau squared?
Yeah, so there's a simple argument and a more sophisticated way with the redistribution functions, and you see by just writing out the mass balance. I probably could find some slides where it's explained in detail if you're interested.
But could you, can we think of it as a one tau factor times another tau factor? Can we two separate terms?
Simple mass balance.
Mm-hmm.
So the rate of change of the total mass. A zero times W is the volume when nucleation takes place. Nu is the rate of nucleation. M is the mass per microtubule that comes in. The mass per microtubule
an average is something like velocity times tau. Then you have an m over tau here, which gives you a tau square. So there's a tau times m, and then this range. Little m is velocity times tau.
One of the questions is like, what the width spindle as a scale and the length scale? I mean, like, why not? You know, because then you have like more compact covers and stuff.
But that's the question of why the shape doesn't change.
Yes. Why it's like it's, because, you know, like, I'm still thinking about, like, does the initial condition is important or not? Because, you know, okay.
Like the initial condition is not like important. It's just goes
in your mind,
stayed with the attractor. Yeah, also, the experiment doesn't seem to be very robustly get its wings.
No, I mean that, you know, when you assemble the spindle, for example, like if you touch this exact thing, the reason you have like smaller bits is that because chromosomes are more condensed somehow, and then when you form a spindle around it, then you get like a smaller bit. Is it like that, or like how?
I must say that, yeah, the
how it goes from like nothing to the spindle. When you like, you know, because there is some process that you've, you know, we formed.
Yeah, so if you start from chromatin,
yes,
there's nucleation happening around the chromatin, and then as the density of these nucleated molecules gets higher, they start to align. And what is also, but this is a difficult process to understand. One thing, for example, Fosner-Wendt led us computer simulations of this process, which is very interesting. And essentially, it forms a liquid crystal, and then I think you can understand the shape if you take the picture, it's a liquid crystal droplet. And the liquid crystal material is just formed by this nucleation of molecules, which then happen to be dense, and they also interact via these motors and other cross-linking proteins. So it gives you just a dense phase of ordered aligned molecules.
That we have a spherical shape? Is that spherical?
The reason why you have the spherical shape is sort of a liquid crystal effect, because you have defects, which are the poles. You have a boundary condition of the microtubule axis tangential to the surface. You have surface tension, and you have the liquid crystal sort of deformation field, and the energies, and the force balances associated with that give you this shape.
In fact, those lenticular shapes are seen in non-biological.
Yes, exactly. You can see the
liquid crystal systems that have defects.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Very common. Mm-hmm. So I also have a few points on the ceiling spinning, because here sort of the length is somehow set by the length of microtubules, which is a very different picture. And ideas about how this might happen is about pulling and pushing forces of growing shrinking microtubules directly with chromosomes or length-dependent microtubule depolarization. I don't want to go so much into that, but an interesting observation in the case of C. elegans is that the centrosomes are key, and they nucleate a lot of the microtubules, and their organization affects spindle length.
And so when microtubules start with the centrosomes always, or?
For most of them, they nucleated typically at the centrosomes.
Okay. And then they
grow from here, and then they hit the chromatin, and then they, when they hit the chromatin, they essentially push on the chromatin, and then they bind to motors attached to the chromatin, which pull on the microtubules, and therefore there's a balance of pushing and pulling forces here. So there's a subpopulation of microtubules which pushes, and a subpopulation of microtubules which pulls. And then there's a steady state balance of these growing and shrinking microtubules and pulling and pushing forces. And then this whole system is regulated with the help of the centrosome. And the centrosome is sort of built on a blob of material around the centrioles. and this block of material called PCM comes in different sizes, so it aggregates to different sizes. So it's spherical, so it will be the EM picture where you roughly see the PCM block around the centrioles here. Just show you like a movie from Wayne Hines, yeah, where you see these central zones growing. It's about 5.4 AFP, and you see that they grow and they disassemble. You want to say external cell divisions, external cell divisions. And they're really big, but as the cells get smaller, the central zones also get smaller. Shown here, this is the growth curve for central zones. Initial cell P0, one cell stage, then this is a two cell stage, we have two cells, and this is a growth curve of the central zones in here, and then the four cell stage, they get smaller. And this scales with cell volume. And then the spindle length changes with cell size, but it also changes with centrosome size. So here you see half spindle length, so the distance from the centrosome to the chromatin in these different stages of cell division. So P0, the initial cell, is here the biggest one, and then they get smaller. Spindles get smaller as the cell volumes get smaller. Then the next observation here is that if you look at how the centrosome size relates to spindle size, it falls on this curve here. And you see the different colors correspond to the cells of different size in subsequent divisions. So the centrosomes get smaller and the spindles get smaller. And now the interesting point is that this can be sort of the change of spindle length can be triggered directly by perturbing centrosomes without changing cell. So here we have a case RNAi of a centrosome component was wild type green, so this would be a P0 cell, I think. And then this is the wild type condition, centrosome size, spindle size, and now an RNAi of a component that of the centrosome leads to smaller centrosomes. You see here, they look smaller, and their spindle is smaller. The cell is the same size before, and the spindle shrinks as the centrosome shrinks. Here in different RNAi condition, where the centrosomes are asymmetric. So this is
the, what is the gene that's being knocked out?
SPUT2.
Well, what is that?
That's something it's a component of the centrosome PCM. It's not it's one of the matrix components. And as it is now lacks material to build centrosomes, you get smaller centrosomes and you get a smaller spindle. Here it's a different, it's a centriole component that is knocked down here, which makes the two duplicated centrioles different from each other. And then you get two different centrosomes, so one bigger than the other. And one finds that one half spindle is shorter than the other half spindle. So the centrosome can influence the length of the half spindle, which is quite marked.
So, sorry, you're going to tell us why.
I can just give you some evidence. I cannot really answer all the questions. It is a puzzling observation, but what was then shown is that this is also related, so that the centrosome size communicates with spindle length. It will be a molecule called TPXL. That's a molecule that forms a complex of the kinase that is important in this spindle assembly process. And knocking down TPXL on the centrosome is already enough to shorten the spindle. And this TPXL forms gradients on reaching out from the centrosome on the spindle microtubules. So this here is a measured concentration profile. Here are the centrosomes, here's the chromatin. And these TBXL molecule has a greater concentration profile on microtubules. So that's the profile when we measure on individual microtubules. It's sort of determined from the overall fluorescence intensity divided by the tubulin intensity to sort of get the intensity profile per microtubules. And so the picture here is that one has these profile. Interestingly, when the spindle size changes, we see that its profile sort of stretches by mechanisms that we don't understand. So our we didn't publish that, but we had a model that could account for a coherent picture of what we observe by the idea that the TPXL level near the on the chromatin would regulate the rate at which microtubules switch from pushing to pulling and then to attachment. Sort of this pushing and pulling force balances could be regulated by such a gradient and thereby sending the spindle. But since this was sort of a somewhat naive model, we could not really show that it was actually true. We didn't have a prediction, but that's sort of the way we thought about the problem.
How the length of the how it controls the length of microtubules? Can you tell me?
So when the when microtubules grow, they can poke the chromatin and they could in principle also go through it. But the moment they bind to one of these motors that pull the microtubules, these typically also depolymerize, so that it holds onto the motor. As the motor moves forward, the microtubule shortens. The microtubule is sort of attached at its tip at the chromatin. And then you have a force balance, and these motors then together set the length of these microtubules. And then at some point the microtubules detach, and there's a catastrophe and they disappear. And then new microtubules, okay? And then you have a turnover of these microtubules.
But then how
the force balance.
But then how TPXL affect that?
Now the idea, that's, I don't know. I don't want to say we know how it works. I'm just saying we have one model that does a good job and which essentially, so first you can build a model where the spindle length depends on the kinetics of these rates at which microtubules in the chromatin find motors and then detach from these motors. And if those rates are then modulated by some the concentration of some molecule that sits on the microtubules, you can adjust spindle length by the concentration that comes here. I don't want to go into too much detail here because this is not something that is finished work. It's just some ideas.
But this is the system you guys have measures of variation among.
Yes.
I think we should discuss it. It's a while ago that we thought about this, and I can show you the data.
We make predictions about what might be the molecular basis.
Mm-hmm. But we could try some of these ideas and see whether it makes sense to you. I just wanted to, at the end, when we saw this, we were intrigued by the fact that this is a concentration profile that stretches when the microtubules change their length. And that is very reminiscent. This happens in cells and microtubules, and it's very reminiscent to what is called scaling of morphogen gradients in tissues. And except that this is in the cells level, in the tissue level, there are similar effects which we looked at in the fly wing. So the fly wing, they are patterning the systems creating wings, and these are scalable in the sense that they can build wings of the same systems can build wings in different species of very different size. And what one finds is that this is organized with the help of concentration profiles of so-called morphogens. In this case, DPP is a key molecule. And there one can show that these concentration profiles, they're secreted locally and then spread in a tissue. And because of degradation and diffusion, they create such exponential shape profiles. And they also stretch as tissue grows. There's a similarity between this rescaling of a characteristic decay length in the case of tissue level concentration profiles and in the case of cell
level concentration profiles. Completely different systems, but a similar phenomenon. And I don't think it's basically, it's neither really understood in the cell nor in the tissue, but it's something which seems to happen again and again.
Those are true exponentials or 1 over L?
That's difficult to distinguish. So, of course, one possibility is it is, in fact, a power law profile, and it looks the same whatever range you look at. The other picture is it's an exponential profile, and the characteristic length changes. This is, in the case of this data, we tried to distinguish the two, and it was very difficult. In the case of the tissue, there's a lot of evidence that it's exponential. But still there, I think.
Your model is one dimension. Is that correct?
Which model? The tissue is effectively one dimensional.
Yes.
Because you have a line source and two dimensional tissue.
Yes.
In the cell case, there's not really a model, so it's just a drawing.
The data
is one dimensional. Yeah.
Fit best by exponential, decaying exponential. Or not. That's what you've used, but it's not clear.
I don't think we're really committed in this case. It is really not so easy to distinguish. And depending on which model you build, you get either one or the other case.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with the problem of orders of magnitude. Yeah? It's easy to see that this is a power law if you have 5 decades.
Yes, sure.
It is only 1 decade, so whether it's an exponential or a power law, you cannot easily distinguish. And it's not clear whether power law really is meaningful over 1 decade or half a decade.
So can I ask evolutionary questions? So you argue for tissues and make it for this that these mechanisms allow the cell to continue making spindles or making ring patterns, even though the overall scale might change.
Mm.
So for something like this to evolve, you would accidentally have to have evolved this sort of size independence first, and then use that freedom to expand into new niches that require different sizes. This is sort of accidental, or something else which I can't quite imagine right now. What do you think that happens? I mean, you see, which might be a mysterious thing. So why would you have a mechanism that is a good scaling mechanism without first having to try it out at different sizes?
I mean, this may come down to what's the origin of the embryo, for example. Was there a large unicellular organism first, or a large colony of single cell organisms? And you worked out scaling on a small scale there, and this kind of was gradually adapted to very large embryos. And C. elegans isn't very large, it's 50 to 55 micron diameter, so this isn't a millimeter.
But is it a theory?
But one way to answer your question is to look at his talk, and you built a spindle, which is essentially this little liquid crystal structure, and you can just provide more or less mass, and you get the same structure, bigger or smaller. So it's intrinsically scalable in that sense. You could start a system, or a megatubules, they can become longer or shorter. You have systems that can come in different sizes, and then the only thing that you need is to regulate the size to whatever is useful in the conditions that are given. So my impression is that the systems are from the beginning scalable in some range.
Accidentally. Just
by the way they're constructed. I'm not sure if that's the evidence for that claim, but your example is a good one because it's just by the physical constraints you can change the size.
But how easy is it to make a scale? Are systems generically scalable? Self-assembled systems? Or I would imagine they're not. I would imagine there are some that just very much lock into place at this scale. There are others. So the question is, what fraction of random systems that make something of that shape? They scalable.
I mean, what's interesting here is that there's this large scalable range, but you see in all organisms there's an upper limit to the spindle, or most organisms. I can show examples in like yeast where it always looks like a power law, always looks linear, but these cells aren't getting to be, a millimeter in length. There's a restriction on that. Yeah, I think there's some fundamental intrinsic coupling with cell size and scalability. And then, you know, once you get really far, much larger, then the questions become very exciting of how do you achieve that, because that probably can't happen on its own, or if the spindle doesn't scale, does that even matter? Because the spindle that, you know, is scaling in this range that you see in C. elegans or mouse or smaller cells in Xenopus, then it's, you know, it's 1/20th of the length of the largest cell. So, but it still functions. So there's a different adaptation to allow it to center and to be functional at that length scale. And that probably was evolved maybe later, you know, but the earlier kind of homeostatic coupling of size and intracellular structure sizes is maybe.
Can you make a general statement that you much prefer dynamic couplings to static ones? Because later than the larger scale? I mean, so I'm just looking for something to hang.
There are some sort of problems with the repetition of the same thing. And the
I'm not sure what's static intracellular.
Nothing is static. Everything is dynamic. Nothing is static.
Well,
I mean, something's
iterable. What sets the gradient? How is the gradient set up inside a cell?
So apparently the TPXL is recruited to the centrosome very strongly. And then it can...
Protein by protein.
So the simplest picture is it's a protein, yes, which comes with kinase attached, and it activates the kinase, and what it does. But probably there are different phosphorylation states associated with it, and then it comes in one phosphorylation state to the centrosome from the cytoplasm, and then maybe it's changed, and then it tends to diffuse on microtubules, and then you can think, in, for example, being switching state again, detaching from microtubules, and then you would already get a characteristic decay length from diffusion coefficient and a time spent in the bound state. That would give you such a characteristic deepening of the connection.
It's mainly diffusing around, and then
it would be the picture. Yeah. The picture, it would diffuse and could be detached. Another picture would be it diffuses and detaches by collective effects. For example, two of them come together, form a dimer, and then they detach. And this picture would give you a power law profile. So there are simple scenarios which would create this effect. And if it were a power law profile, you would naturally get the effect that you make the system longer and it looks the same. Well, if it is an exponential profile, then you would have to adjust the lifetime spent bound in order to stretch the profile. But we don't know what is happening, which mechanisms are at work. Also easy to understand, to see the kinetics of. I'm just suggesting scenarios. We see there's a gradient. We know everything turns over, but we don't know the kinetics of diffusion along microtubules and detachment and detachment from microtubules.
Could we try another protein?
I don't know, but if there's also drift, there are also ways to set up gradients. But clearly, it comes from the centrosome,
yeah.
And then it spreads on the microtubule.
But the motor proteins, they work in one direction.
And
you could also
get probably such a gradient that gets transported back towards the centrosome by some motors, but it's pure speculation.
Yeah.
In the vertebrate systems, it has, like the Xenopus, it has both the Aurora kinase A binding, but also has egg 5 binding, so it's
okay
with kinase A5. But I think that domain's missing from the C. elegans version.
Yeah.
But can you see it colocalized with microtubules? Do you have the resolution to see that, or?
I think we can.
Yes.
But it's not so clear cut.
You can. The point that you made, that I thought was very clear about the role of chromosomes and all of this,
mm-hmm.
and that simple spindle, you don't need chromosomes, you need
right.
DNA on beads. But what about things like this where worms have this holocentric chromosomes? Is that what you mean? So they don't have a centromere, like mammalian chromosomes.
Yeah, it's predicated
on the same. So does that have any influence? Does anybody think on the shape? So mammalian chromosomes, yeast chromosomes, there's like one place, and the microtubules all attach to that one place, and then yank it.
It just means that it's not evenly spread here.
It's everywhere.
It's everywhere.
Yeah.
The microtubules go.
Does that have, do you think that has any It's almost on the shape or the whatever we call this, the bitumen spindle, or no? No evidence of that.
I feel like the Kamar lab is arguing for a relationship between having all the central chromosomes in some aspect of the aspect ratio. I can't remember what the...
Kamar.
But it's a good point about the DNA is, you know, by modifying the amount of PCM or centrosome size, this is a source of microtubule nucleation.
Yeah, yeah.
And the DNA is also a source of microtubule nucleation. So there's many ways to generate microtubules in the system.
Yeah.
And they can vary from one organism to the other, and the meiotic versus the mitotic. This certainly what's tricky about the real details in the system is yeah, there's many knobs to turn, and I think that's what's kind of maybe fun and interesting to think about evolutionarily is the scalability with volume or the scalability of centrosome size or turning the dial on a microtubule polymerase. They're all potentially control parameters,
yeah.
And I think we're all trying to kind of
yeah.
tease them out
yeah.
experimentally now, and then who knows what if someone could really make it figure out if that was an evolutionary step to evolve that architecture that length in a certain organism would be really neat. And I don't know if that's what you feel like you guys are going to talk about it, or you guys, Dan, will talk about it. You know?
I think Dan.
I have a question for the yeast experts. Is there an analog of the Frank's growth velocity and length law for yeast you could come up with? Is there even closed mitosis?
Yeah, we talked a little bit about
could
closed.
Measure velocity of microtubule extension in the nucleus.
But in yeast, I guess the microtubules hit the wall and somehow then they shrink afterwards.
Well,
they... Yeah, but... Yeah. It's a set of plasma, I mean...
Mm-hmm. I meant the nucleus.
Inside of the mm-hmm. once you make a, once okay. you make a spindle mm-hmm. inside of the nucleus.
Yeah.
Intranuclear spindle.
So, I don't know. I would think that someplace probably this data maybe maybe this data exists that could be used as a basis for thinking about that, mm-hmm. like how fast does a spindle grow, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
But I don't know of anybody taking these kinds of sophisticated approaches to asking those kinds of questions.
Well, I'm just thinking about from the point of view of data, what's out there.
Yeah, we were talking about in terms of the concentration of tubulin and how it's different in a closed mitosis because all of the tubulin that can get used to make a spindle comes from depolymerization of the cytoplasmic microtubules, and then it has to get transported into this pretty small space.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that, you know, there's some sort of limiting.
And is it only transported inside when it's needed there, or is it transported inside all the time?
People believe in fungi that it's transported there where it needs, when it needs to be.
Mm.
But there's like a filamentous fungus, Aspergillus, where right when they're getting ready to go into mitosis, their nuclear pores change, and the thing that they can see like coming in is like tubulin. So the pores open up at mitosis and tubulin goes in. Although, of course, everything goes in. Everything goes in, everything goes out. It's just like a channel instead of.
But does it mean it can go in without an explicit transporter? Or is it still using the same transporter as usual?
I don't think I can remember enough to answer that mm-hmm. specific question. But it's definitely the case that the protein composition of the nuclear pores themselves changes. Like lots of proteins leave the nuclear pore and somehow it opens up. Seems to be sort of a freely diffusible channel. And then to be able to
it's almost like breaking down the envelope.
It is. I'll talk about that.
Are there fission or budding mutants that affect spindle size? That you could then say, oh, yeah, this is a different L than this wild type case, and then I could, you know, make a log plot and try,
yeah,
or a linear log, or just a linear plot and see if.
I think there are vehicles in which you can do these, have them in which they end up with different size spindles. But mechanistically, how that's happening.
There's some pretty good work on these force balance models for Pondy. And I don't know about the second piece of this, like dependent microtubule depolarization in that system, but there's definitely.
From Fong.
But there's definitely motors that you can knock out their activity, mm-hmm. and you can get a longer, shorter spindle. Mm-hmm.
Somebody should exploit some of them, like yeast, and both the yeasters.
Yeah, both the yeasters.
They have like a few hundred genome sequence, aren't there? Maybe there's not as many for Cerevisiae, but I think Pondy's are, there's at least 100 genome sequence, so it'd be a beautiful resource to do the kind of comparative stuff. And you'd already have all the nuclear genomes.
But we didn't see it.
Because there seems to be such diversity in spindle form and open closed mitosis.
Yeah.
I mean, how do these things diverge from the common instance for a long time?
We don't get any cookies.
It could be gone. Yeah, likely. I don't know.
That's usually good.
Are we okay?
Thank you.
Just closing out. Thanks a lot.